Hello everyone, how are you doing? If you're new here, I'm Dr. Sheen, an Oxford and Cambridge graduate, a tech entrepreneur and business coach.
And welcome back to Dream Girl. And today we're joined by a very, very special guest. So we're joined by Mehreen Khan, who is the economic editor of The Times. And most importantly, she has been my best friend of 13 years. She might disagree, but we are going to get into it.
This will be very different from the usual episodes in the sense that it won't be serious in any way. And I think in this one, I will be allowing my guests to ask some questions as well. Hi, Mehreen.
That makes me sound old. Hello.
Hello. Me too. Imagine 13 years.
It's a long time, yeah.
Okay, so we will get onto who you are as a person, but for now, why are you sitting like this?
What?
You look uncomfortable.
Mastermind. Okay. I mean, my body language is open. Okay.
Please open.
I'm calm.
Okay, so tell us, how do we know each other? We have different stories about how we know each other.
We know each other because we met at university.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a young fresher or freshman for the Americans,
mm-hmm.
from Mauritius, and I was closer to the end of my studies.
Mm-hmm.
And we met through mutual friends, just it's a small town.
Yeah.
And yeah, and we're still here.
Yeah, and the first time I met Mehreen, I was 18.
Yeah.
And I remember clearly meeting her, thinking she's really cool. 2 days later, I see her on the streets and I wave at her and she blanks me.
There's a point in your life at university when all the freshmen just look the same. So
at that point, I was still just one part of the background.
You were just one of many.
Mm-hmm.
I've apologized for that numerous times, so I'm actually not going to apologize for it again.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Tell us about you now. What do you do? Just introduce yourself.
I'm a journalist. I work in London. I write for a newspaper about lots of topics around economics. I've been a journalist for nearly a decade. I've worked in Europe. I've lived in Brussels. I've written about the economy, politics, financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I spend my day doing.
What got you into it?
I fell into financial journalism by accident because I studied history at university. Means I'm qualified for nothing, really. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be a sports journalist. I really wanted to sort of channel my love for football and other things and make that my career. And I was very lucky that when I got my first real job at a British national newspaper, they wanted me to work on their sports desk. And at that point, I actually said no, because I found it quite an intimidating environment, quite a sexist environment, not the newspaper itself, but the sort of milieu around sports journalism and sports journalists. And it was already something that I found that I would probably struggle with as a younger person. So I switched to an area of journalism, which I didn't know much about, wasn't really qualified for. But it seemed to be meritocratic in the sense that if you were good at it, your gender or your age or even the color of your skin sometimes wouldn't really matter. So I fell into financial journalism by accident and I'm still here.
Loving it?
It's very interesting. I think when, there's a perverse thing that it's a bit like being a war correspondent, right? So when the economy is doing very, very badly, I have lots of work to do to try and explain to people what's happening, why it matters for them. More people are trying to be engaged in areas like personal finance. People seem to be more financially literate, but they don't necessarily understand things like macroeconomics. And so I have a relatively serious job, but would hope that if I'm doing it well, then I'm explaining it to people in an accessible way and trying to communicate why things like the economy, which seem quite theoretical and amorphous, really matter for people's lives.
Oh, wow. Okay. First of all, this is really weird for us to talk about your job so seriously.
I don't think you've ever asked me about my job before, probably.
I mean, I know you're a journalist. I didn't know more than that.
Yeah.
But it is so interesting to hear. And I mean, obviously, I knew your journey. But for you, what would you say has been the highlight so far? One of the highlights.
I mean, I've written things that I think are important.
Mm.
And at the time, they seem really important. And the problem of the 24-hour news cycle is that the relevance and the longevity of these things is very short. So in the moment, you break a news story, everyone's talking about it. It's an agenda-setting news story. But then the next day, there's something else. So it's quite a fleeting environment. It's one where you're working on very short deadlines. I think if I step back and just think, I'm in a relatively senior position at a very prestigious newspaper. If 10 years ago when we were hanging out in libraries and in parks and punting, I wouldn't have even have dreamt to have been in this position. It was not something that I was even considering in the realm of possibilities. I didn't know any journalists. I don't have journalists in my family. I didn't have friends who were journalists. It was a very alien world that I was breaking into. And I think the thing that I'm probably proud of is that I'm still kind of sticking in there. And you know, I've done many, many jobs, including things that I would consider to be my dream jobs. And if you told the 21-year-old me that this was going to happen, I just wouldn't have believed you.
I have to say, every time I talk about you to my friends, and obviously, you know, I'm a bit of a clout chaser, so I have to describe what you do. Everyone is always like, this is so impressive. And I do think it's impressive, you know, seeing, obviously, I knew you as a loser in university, and now where you are now, it's pretty cool what you have achieved. And if now you were to look back and you were to give advice to any, especially young women, women of color who are trying to break into journalism, what would you tell them?
So journalism has a representation problem. And I'm basically talking about media in the West. Mm-hmm. So English language media does have a problem. And that's almost fundamentally a flaw of the industry, because if I really have to crystallize what journalism is, you're telling stories, right? And you're telling stories sometimes about people and sometimes about sort of stuff. So I write about stuff, inflation, unemployment, interest rates. These are things. And so the representation problem is I think, chronically an issue, a fundamental structural problem in journalism, because when you have people who only feel able to tell certain types of stories, then that creates it's a narrowing of the media spectrum. So I've been in newsrooms where men have felt uncomfortable about writing Me Too stories, mm-hmm. and women don't. So they take an onus upon themselves if they're writing about a sector to write Me Too stories. I work in an environment where, even though I don't like, I'm not a race correspondent. I don't have a beat which involves thinking about societal things. I write about economics, but I find it very difficult not to feel a burden or an onus to be somebody that will broaden my newspaper's horizons when it comes to these topics. So people who want to break into journalism, I think it's almost a marker of success when you can break into an industry which is desperate for more representation, but to find a job where you're not the brown person correspondent as the brown person, right? The fact that someone like me, so I'm the first female to have ever held the economics editor job at my newspaper. I work at the Times of London.
Yeah.
I'm the first woman to have the job of economics editor. I'm the first woman of color to have the job of economics editor. And I'm probably, although it's difficult to verify, among one of the youngest people to have the job. And for me, I'm very proud of that, because it has nothing to do with any other parts of me. I've often worked in a newsroom where people have looked around, spotted me and said, can you write this story about something to do with... I was once approached by an editor to say, can you write a story about ISIS brides? And this was at a point when I was writing about financial markets. And, you know, it wasn't a coincidence that this person, who was a very senior person managing the newspaper, just looked around, saw my name, saw me, and sort of, he actually told me to go down to my local mosque to go and find an ISIS bride. And this is not a very long time ago. And it's not at my current newspaper, but this is at a very prominent newspaper which has an international reading. So if you want to get into this type of industry, of course, I'm not saying to younger people, don't write about the things that you care about. But if you want to be a journalist because you like telling stories and all other types of stories, then if you can find a job in which you are able to talk about politics, economics, society, culture, sport, and it's not about you, I think that's a marker of progress. And I would just encourage people to feel very self-confident about their abilities to do that, and not to be put in that box of you're our little representative or X community. And I think there is a move in journalism to become more representative, but I think we're at this kind of stage where that representation means putting brown people or women into jobs about brown people and women. And maybe it's a little bit of a step forward, but I think that means that we're actually probably doing a disservice to the idea of representation when we keep people in these boxes. So, journalism is very intimidating for lots of people. The nature of the industry has changed so much. I imagine most people who are probably under the age of 30 or 35 listening to this don't really read newspapers in a traditional sense. They probably get their news sources from lots of different sites. They don't have a loyalty to a particular news brand. They're quite promiscuous as consumers of news. And that basically has just changed the whole nature of my industry, is that I'm not really sure who I'm writing for anymore. And I think that's true of a lot of people in this business.
Wow. Okay. You've talked about a lot of things. I had questions that I've forgotten, but the ones that I did pick up on is something that we talk about a lot on the podcast as well, which is, you know, now that it does feel like the whole DEI thing is just a tick box exercise. And even, you know, when it comes to founders, whenever we're raising money, now there's a tick box that at least 5% of your VC funds needs to go to female founders. And people have an issue with that because it does feel like it's a band-aid at the end of the day. And you're just choosing to like promote someone who might not be as good as someone else just based on DEI requirements. But then there's also the counter argument for this, which is, well, if we don't start now, the people who are already in the process are just going to lose out. Yes, we need systemic change. That will take time. So how do you
I mean, this? I struggle with this all the time, and sometimes I change my mind on it a lot. And I think I used to be of the opinion that representation is just very important. Mm. Just get more people in the room that are different.
Yeah.
Because in a newspaper sense, and I can't really speak more to kind of the entrepreneurial side, but in a newspaper sense, you know, and people who read newspapers and find things that are really culturally insensitive when they read them. And I often wonder, so how did we come to a place where we've printed something that is clearly culturally insensitive, mm-hmm. wrong, the wrong choice of vernacular, etc. And that's because when there is decisions being made about commissioning this piece or writing this piece or editing this piece, there's no one there saying, you know what, guys, actually, maybe we shouldn't use that word. Word has connotations. Yeah. Mm. Right. And just having those people around means that fewer of those incidents are likely to happen. Mm. Right. So that's some senses why diversity in the newsroom is important. But I also have a problem with what I have experienced in my life, which is also tick box diversity. And often I've been in newsrooms in different environments where I feel the burden and the pressure of being the Muslim girl and the brown girl. And it's kind of difficult to explain to your colleagues because they don't necessarily feel what you feel.
Mm.
And it's often in more progressive environments politically that I have found that more people expect me to behave in a certain way and to have certain views that they would expect someone of me to have, rather than in say, centrist, right-leaning news organizations where actually no one really cares about your skin color, ethnicity, religion. And that's, I think, one of the ironies of like having worked in a space like the media, is that when people are trying really hard to be progressive and open and inclusive, they actually, all they seem to do is just say that you're the acceptable, it's the good Muslim problem, which I often get. You're supposed to have these types of views because that's why you're here, and you have to conform to
this type. You're different to the rest.
Yeah, but you have to conform to our stereotype of what the good Muslim should be like. And loads of people have written about this before. And most of the time, I don't have good Muslim views because ultimately the world changes very quickly, and you might remain remarkably ideologically consistent, but the world in which that message is getting sent out is different. Being a good Muslim in 2001, mm-hmm. after 9/11, would have been very different from being a good Muslim in 2023.
Yeah.
And we need to get away from this idea that when we have representation, these people are supposed to perform a certain type of role. And that's something that I still see in the media a lot. And there will be change. It will happen slowly. But it requires, I think, people in senior jobs in the media to look different, sound different. And that means being working class. That means not going to the same universities as everyone else. Not necessarily living in London. That's a big problem that we have in the UK, is that London is such, it sucks so much of the brain talent of the UK. It also means that we stop putting a burden of representation on the two or three people in our newsroom.
Mm.
At some point, you need a critical mass of people where change can be achieved. So I'm not really against the first couple of steps, which can seem like tick boxing, but you have to reach a tipping point where cultural change then comes about because of one force of numbers and these people rising through the ranks of their various organizations to then be in places where they can institute change. And what I think is really important is hiring, right? People hire in their own image, right? Yeah. They see things that resonate with them, right? Once you're in a position that is senior enough that you have hiring power, I think that's closer to like where tipping points can happen and real change can emerge, because that's the root of all of this, really, is when you sit across a table from someone, what do you see in them?
Yeah.
And often most people just want to hire in their own image.
100%. And that's the same for even university admissions. It's always people are looking for themselves or what they recognize. They don't necessarily appreciate where you come from, what are all the hurdles until you got here, they think that it's the same. And that's always a bit of an issue. But also, okay, another thing you mentioned is the good Muslim thing. I have a very cool story about this. I don't know if I ever told you. So when I was still doing my PhD, and I was the only Muslim in my group, my research group. And one time we went for dinner and I asked, it was five guys, and I asked, is it halal? And they said, no, unfortunately, it's not halal. And the manager felt so bad of five guys. He was like, you know what? Whatever you want, that's veggie. You can have it for free. So I didn't pay for my meal. And this one guy, senior, okay, he comes to me and he's laughing his head off. He's like, can't believe you got a free meal. I bet you don't even care if it's halal. And for a minute, I was like, why would he think that I don't care? Because I would have just eaten the non-halal food if I didn't care. But he then went to explain that he thought, yeah, you're Muslim, but you're different.
Yeah.
Because he thinks if I'm within them and he likes me as a person, it means that I'm not the other type of Muslim. Mm. So yeah, that was just the story that came to mind. I haven't thought about this in a while.
I think we've all got the story.
Yeah.
And I think the bigger picture of being the good Muslim is that when you get to quite elite environments and elite spaces, the idea of being religious is anathema to most people. Like, they associate religious belief with being backwards. Conservative to the point of like stupidity and basically living in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that I've been in these elite spaces where other people who self-identify as Muslims often who've made had career opportunities because they self-identify with Muslims, look at me at a dinner not drinking and they're like, what?
Mm.
Really? They also assume that it's just a facade.
Yeah.
That your faith is a facade and you're actually using it
it's
to get
brand.
On. Yeah, it's part of your brand. You're using it to get on. Yeah. They're like, so you actually do the 16-hour fast and you're really not drinking.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned it because this chauvinism exists within the Muslim community between people who practice Islam.
Yes.
Or, you know, practice it in a hidden way. I mean, I'm not saying that they're like zealot in any way. Yeah. They preach, but they have a quiet observation of the basics of what we would consider Islam. And then I guess Muslims who identify as being perhaps more enlightened, evolved, who think that the practice of Islam is actually, you know, like they're culturally Muslim, and there's a bigger debate about whether that's allowed, you know, what being culturally Muslim is. So you get it from both sides. You get it from secular people who think you must be an idiot. I was told by a senior newspaper editor that I should be disqualified from my profession for believing in God, because if I believed in these fantasy stories, then I clearly had no objective sense of what reality is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Richard Dawkins makes this argument a lot. I mean, this is when he was trolling journalists like Mehdi Hassan a few years ago on the internet, saying, if you believe this is true, then you objectively cannot be working in a profession where you have to make judgments about the truth. Mm-hmm. And I've had this as a relatively young reporter from very senior people at international news organizations telling me exactly this thing.
And how do you deal with it?
I am not shy.
Yeah.
And often I enjoy this intellectual tussle because I would rather people say what they feel about what they think I am than for it to be hidden and it then to come out in different ways or the way that I may be treated. So actually when this conversation happened, I was in a car with the senior editor and his younger son who was sitting between us. And the younger son clearly understood that his father at this point, I mean, it's not most of these people are men, was being completely outrageous.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, my argument was that if you think that a belief in God, which is still the majority of the world's population identify with having a faith, if you think that we're all backwards, uncivilized cave people, then your grasp on the world that you write about, because this person lives in Britain, lives in London, where there are 2 million Muslims. The fact that you would believe to be in such a position of apparent intellectual superiority that you think these people are this way, whatever he was accusing me of, shows that you have no objective grasp on the reality of the world that you live in, let alone the city, the country. Yet, and yet you are in such a position where you write about these people all the time.
Oof.
Like, so who's the bad journalist?
Yeah.
Me for believing in God or for you not having the basic understanding of what it might mean for someone to have faith? Mm-hmm. But and that's why I often tell people who are so ignorant of Islam, it's just so strange to me that there are so many Muslims in the UK. We have some degree of cultural and political weight in terms of representation. Mm-hmm. And yet there are people who run our newspapers and our corporations who don't know the first thing about the very basic fundamentals of what it might mean to be a Muslim. And these are opinion formers. These are opinion shapers. These are people who set the political agenda, right? Who write about the day-to-day life of Britain and you know, societal issues and class issues and the difference between cities and countryside. And they yet know nothing because they haven't done the first job of journalism, which is to get off your butt and go and talk to people and then write it down. First rule of journalism.
Yeah.
You can sit in your ivory tower and form as many opinions as you like. Have you actually ever spoken to someone that you think believes X, Y, Z and therefore must be A, B, C?
Mm-hmm.
Right? No. And the answer is often no. And that's, you know, again, it's one of the many ironies of working in this profession is that I'm often told about what I should be like and who I am.
Yeah.
And if these people haven't taken 5 minutes to speak to me about what I might actually believe, then the masses that they're writing about, they have no connection or no ability to access these people and just to chat to them. That's what I do. I talk to people and then I write it down and, you know, try and form narratives out of it. So who's a bad journalist, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Love that story. You know, somebody told me, again, someone from same circles of elite friends from Oxford and Cambridge who told me that if I consider raising my kids Muslim, that's child abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've all had that one.
Are you right?
Yeah. Child abuse. You're so, you know, you're so limited. Like, you know, people accuse you of racism when you say you want to marry somebody who's Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Small-mindedness.
Yep.
Often get told that having a sense of responsibility towards people and, you know, follow your heart. Do you know, this hyper-individualistic, uber-liberal sense that what's good is what makes you happy.
Yeah.
And that's the prevailing norms that run most of Western society.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people that we know that we would consider to be friends are very well-meaning when they say this.
Yeah.
But we always think they're going to go home and think, God, she's so oppressed.
Right.
She doesn't even know it. She's
she
so dumb.
Yeah. You know, they'll think she's so bright, but she can't see this.
Such a waste.
If only we could help her.
Yeah. she's so dumb and so oppressed. She doesn't even know she's oppressed.
She doesn't even know.
You know?
But isn't it weird that people would think that about people like us?
Yeah.
That we're oppressed.
Yeah. I'm oppressed.
Oh my days. Okay. I think this whole thing about us being, okay, let's get into this, you know, being young Muslims, because obviously you are in the UK, you're in the West, I'm in the Middle East. I used to be in the West as well. And weirdly enough, I feel like here, I find it harder to be a practicing Muslim.
Yeah. Probably just for the reason that I said, right?
Yeah.
That you get more judgment.
So much more judgment. And I think, especially here, the whole non-alcohol thing, oh my days, people don't get it. They're like, why? But what is wrong with you? Yeah. Like, it's fine. Back in the days, this was like this. It's fine. And you're like, okay. But how about we let people have a choice? I think that's what bothers me. The whole, let's be modern and be free, but not everybody's free.
So here's the irony. If you're in a situation where you're not drinking and you say to someone, well, 'cause I'm doing dry January or detox, they'd be like, yeah, of course, yeah, sure. Mm. Right? So there are legitimate reasons not to drink. And then there are the reasons that you're secretly oppressed.
Yeah.
Isn't it so weird that she actually believes in the thing that, you know, she believes in her religion?
Just like intermittent fasting.
Yes.
People are good on you. Yeah. 16 hours, you're not going to eat. And then if you're like, yeah, I'm fasting because it's Ramadan. Yeah. People are like,
don't you just go into the corner and like get a cheeky snack? And
do you drink some water when you wash your mouth?
Yeah, when no one's looking. And I'm like, so when you're doing your dry whatever it is or detoxing, do you go and break your fast and break your ketosis or the thing that you're trying to achieve, whatever nirvana you're trying to achieve during this?
Right.
So that's the whole irony of, like, you know, even when people, you know, I know that it's very popular now to meditate, to take a few minutes out of your day to breathe and take time for yourself, right? Many Muslims do that already because they pray often as much as 5 times a day, which involves taking a few minutes out of your day, breaking your routine, and just spending some minutes with yourself and God.
Yeah.
Right. But if you just said, oh, I'm actually just going to put the prayer down on the mat and I'm going to meditate. I'm going to meditate. Yeah. They'd be like, yeah, sure, do your thing. But if you were like, I'm going to, you know, where's the Qibla? You just get Yeah. You know, so I think the ironies of this whole, you know, sense of judgment that you get from people who define themselves as being secular or perhaps atheist or non-religious, mm-hmm. is that actually they seem to be striving for exactly the same things. But when you tell them your motivation is God, yeah. and not the self.
If the tag is God, yeah.
Because
yeah,
wellness is about the self, ultimately. Mm-hmm. It's about trying to do something to help yourself.
Yeah.
And I think as Muslims, we get the benefits of the self when we strive to make God happy.
Mm.
The reason that people are religious and have faith is because they know it helps them in their day-to-day life, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But we don't frame it as a wellness issue. We frame it as something about faith.
Mm-hmm.
But we get all the rewards from the intermittent fasting, from the meditating, yeah. from the journaling,
all the wellness,
from the non-drinking.
Comes, yeah.
The wellness is a happy and natural consequence
yeah.
of putting God first.
Right. But I feel like, okay, in today's time, it takes so much resilience and strength as well to stick by it, because you'll get pushback from everyone about why you're doing it. And then when you think about in... You know, even now with social media and everyone wants to conform. Everyone wants to belong. No one wants to be the odd one out. And I see so many people who I used to know back in the days who are now, you know, kind of like moving away from their faith for different reasons. And now I worry, what is it going to be like for our children, the next generation? I don't know what it's going to be like. So
I imagine our parents probably had exactly the same thoughts. So not my parents, but my grandparents, when they moved to England.
True.
You know, this is the migrant dilemma, is
yeah.
that you move often for economic reasons and to have a sense of prosperity. But there's always a trade-off about how your children who are now being raised in the West, going to Western schools, going to be. And some parents, you know, impose quite strict cultural norms on their kids and put them to religious education so they have everything. And then ultimately, when they grow up, they choose. Others are, you know, perhaps just have a sense in which everything will be okay. So I think ultimately, if you are a believer, then you think that every generation has its own tests. Mm. We had ours, mm-hmm. probably as like these sort of second to third generation, you know, multiple identity kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, who are British and Muslim and something else, or American and something else.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Mauritian who's experienced the West and now lives outside Mauritius. So we are these third culture kids. And then in some senses, I think it might be easier for our children, because at least they might have more of a sense of rootedness in where they are, because if they have parents and grandparents who are also, you know, my grandparents are buried in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
First generation of my family,
mm-hmm.
where their graves
are there yeah.
in the local small towns of England.
Yeah.
And that is something which roots you in a place.
Roots now, yeah. yeah.
Right? They're there. We're not going anywhere. I mean, I still grew up thinking that, you know, being told sometimes by my parents, I don't know whether they were just saying it, but they were like, you know, they might send us back home. And I'm like, where's home? This is home.
For you, this is home.
There's nothing else,
yeah.
you know? We all, I think, second, third generation migrants, first generation definitely, live with this anxiety that they might kick us out.
Yeah, because back in the days, some people did get kicked out
yes.
of where they were.
Yes,
yeah.
And most South Asians in the UK ended up in the UK because they experienced one of the, you know, the worst atrocities since the Holocaust, which was partition,
yeah.
which is literally people waking up one day having to leave their homes
yeah.
and move.
Yes.
And when you go through this degree of trauma, then of course you live with an anxiety.
You're never safe, yeah.
That there is no such thing as political stability. There's no such thing as belonging, because one day you could just have to wake up and be forced to leave mm-hmm. your home. And we grow up with the legacy of this. And I think most people in my generation don't really understand the traumas of our grandparents and our forefathers who experienced things like partition mm-hmm. or economic migration or natural disasters where floods and hurricanes and earthquakes can wipe people out. And so I think it's, you know, we're complacent about all this sort of thing. But I think I would hope, God willing, that our children might have more of a sense of rootedness and stability than our ancestors ever did.
Mm.
And that, again, is a sign of progress and not something that we should take lightly.
Exactly. They'll have different types of problems that we haven't even encountered yet.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that heavy note,
let's
make it a bit more fun. What do you want to ask? Okay, firstly, if you guys want to learn more about Mehreen, there is season 1, it was, right? Yeah, season 1, where we recorded, which was my first time doing the podcast, recorded remotely. You were in Brussels.
I was still in Brussels, yeah.
I was in Cambridge. Now we're here.
Yeah, and it's a chat about journalism, and people who are interested in the media should listen to that. I don't think any of it is particularly outdated. But
no, it's not.
Yeah, for any like budding journalists or people who are intrigued.
Yeah,
by
we've had
the media.
Actual tips and advice on how to navigate that world as well. So now we can make it a bit more fun.
Okay, so my job, my day job is asking people questions.
Let's go.
I'm actually, you know, might be difficult to tell, but I'm quite uncomfortable being the recipient of the question. So maybe I will now go back into
my
natural state.
Don't embarrass me.
No, but okay, so 2 years ago, last summer,
yeah,
I came to Dubai, we took your stuff over, found yourself a flat, you got settled. Fast forward 2 years, you're here.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling in Dubai?
Great question. I think going back to 2 years ago, first of all, find your friend who will help you move, right? Like, that was so
get
kind.
Yourself a Mahreen. I'm not available
for
these services, no.
So you have helped me move many times, even in Oxford, and you've cleaned
you're
my...
quite an anxious mover, whereas I'm very chilled, so it works between
yeah,
us.
Yeah, it does. I just sit there and, you know, stress out while you get the stuff done, which is great. But yeah, no, it's been great. Honestly, I was so excited when you said you were coming now, because I was like, okay, now I'm a bit more settled than when you left me. Do you remember when you left me? I felt like a child being left at nursery, by the way.
You had a SIM card yet, or, you know, your ID hadn't come.
I literally felt like a child being left at nursery, being like, my parent is not coming back. And I had to fend for myself. But now you came back, I have a car. How'd you find my driving, by the way?
Driving great. Parking.
Hey, I just parallel parked.
Yeah, I don't think we can. I don't think it qualifies as parallel parking. But I'm not one to talk about driving, so. That's
yeah,
fine.
Where's your license? Let's see it. But honestly, I think Dubai now, I'm a lot more settled. I have changed jobs many times. I don't seem to be able to stick to one. But in general, I love Dubai now, I have to say. And every time I go outside somewhere else, I can't wait to go home. And that was the first time I realized Dubai became home, because I was honestly, I flew back from London to Dubai and I was like, oh, back to civilization.
Yeah, a lot of people feel that when they fly back from London.
Okay, Heathrow is the ghetto. Okay, I had to walk into a parking lot to find my Uber. Yeah. That you have to order on your phone.
Yeah, it's a regulated taxi business. Mm-hmm. But yes, but I feel like the parent that's come to pick you up after the first term in boarding school,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, I don't want to go home.
Yeah, right.
So that's a great feeling to have.
It is. Know. And I think, okay, I think there are a few things about Dubai that I like and a few things that I don't like still. The things that I like is the availability of opportunities here. It's been incredible in terms of work opportunity, just like expansion opportunity and just meeting different people. It's been incredible. And then it is quite central, so I tend to see a lot of my friends. Whenever they're traveling, they will stop by, or people like you who just come for a quick visit. It's quite easy to do. Then it's really easy for me to keep in touch with people. And also, you know, I'm lazy and incapable in many ways. And the services here is great. It does mean that I am able to live on my own and have a car and have a house without needing to know how to do little things.
Yeah, I don't think there's a cost of living crisis in Dubai. I mean, I don't want to say that in a flippant way. I'm sure there is a cost of living crisis for many people. But
nowhere near.
When you compare the kind of discourse around Western countries, mm-mm. especially the UK,
yeah,
there is a just difference in mood here. And I have, you know, I've got you and I've got other friends here. And honestly, I don't really ever encourage them to come back to London mm-hmm. because I can see that this is a life that that works for them.
Right.
And actually, it's quite an easy place to live.
It is.
And I've lived in countries like Belgium, which are bureaucratically hard places to live. And even London as a Brit, it's still difficult because of rent and property shortages and the fact that there is a availability of career opportunities, but you have to, you know, you really got to grind and stay somewhere for a while to maybe reap the benefits and the fruits of your labor.
Mm-hmm.
And your quality of living is just not anywhere close.
No. And also here, when you talk about like just the mindset here, one thing I realized is that when I was in the West, there was a lot of kind of like scarcity mindset. You're always competing with others. Whenever I was applying for jobs, there's always like limited numbers. You're always competing. But here, there's such an abundance mindset. Mm. There's so much of everything for everybody. And then that feeds into why people will happily help you. Even if they're also doing the same thing as you, they will happily help you because they know that you winning doesn't mean they don't have a chance to win anymore. So that you can also feel that in different ways.
And because I think the nature of Dubai is that people are here for a reason and that reason often involves them working or getting on. There is a sense in which, of course, there's huge wealth inequality here. Mm-hmm. And there's a stratified economy between people who are on the more privileged side and others who are, you know, like disparagingly it's known in the West. And I think quite stereotypically, they call it like the slave economy. Mm-hmm. But again, first rule of journalism is don't have opinions about people that you don't really speak to or you don't understand. And often, even when I'm in environments where you see people who are on lower pay, you realize that the money that they're earning is going back home to sustain families. They have a sense of dignity. They're here to pursue opportunities so their children can have a better life for them. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge amount of, I think, ignorance, stereotype in the West that these places are exploitative. And we use very big words like serfdom and slavery. And I often get this because I'm in political environments where people will make arguments about the UAE. And I know that I also had these stereotypes mm-hmm. before I ever arrived here. But again, first rule, go chat to the people that you think are slaves, or, you know, you've basically stripped them of the dignity of their own livelihoods.
Yeah, very paternalistic.
Yes, it is very paternalistic. Yeah. And it's a very Western-centric view. That's not to say things can't be better and things can't change. But you would hope that that change is generational and that the people who are doing jobs that they are doing out of necessity, mm-hmm. their children and people who come, you know, their extended family, others have opportunity because of them. And so, you know, again, like, there's a constant tension the way the West thinks about countries like the UAE or in the Middle East, that they're built on exploitation of labor. But the sad truth is that the societies in which we live in, which are rich and have industrialized, underwent exactly the same sort of dynamics. And just because they're not in our living memory doesn't mean that they didn't happen.
Yeah, we have forgotten.
Yes, and the process of industrialization, the process of getting rich, creates winners, but it also creates people who in the short term are losers.
It's always on the back of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always on the back of people. And in the West, it's on the back of colonies.
Yeah.
And the people that we never saw, that the Brits never saw, that they were getting rich from. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, yeah, I'm not saying that this is a perfect situation, but I think just historically you have to think about how transformative, painful, and revolutionary sometimes the process of getting rich for countries is. And should we deprive other countries of the opportunities to get rich because we no longer think that the way they want to do it is morally correct?
Exactly. And on that point, like, you are so right. I spoke to my help, who is that, what is the politically correct term, by the way? What would you say?
I think the help has political connotations in America, which was often speaking about black people post-slavery. Yeah. And therefore, I wouldn't use it.
What would you say?
The person, my cleaner.
My cleaner, let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
My cook.
Yeah, so my cleaner.
Whatever the function they,
who is Filipino. And she, I was asking her, I was like, how do you like Dubai? Like, is this okay, is this not okay? And she was saying how from the money she's made, she's been in Dubai for 3 years, she's built a hospital in her village in the Philippines. And she was like, I'm a celebrity back there when I go back. And she was like, I used to sleep on the streets. Mm. Now I sleep in AC here. Mm. Yes, there are other people there. But for me, it's a big leap. And it's a big leap for my village, not even just her family. Mm. And yes, it can be better. Yes, we should aim to be better. But let's not decide for these people that they are modern day slaves.
Yes. And let's tell these people's stories.
Yeah.
Like, how refreshing is it to even hear that?
Yeah.
Because in the narrative around these people is that they don't have names. Mm. Again, like we were talking about how people accuse us of being oppressed and having no agency, that these people are without agency and they've been, you know, shipped over here by people who want to exploit them. And often, I think from what I can gather, the reason that people find their way in Dubai is because they already know people. So it's a kind of word of mouth thing. And you say, I know a family that might require this or that, or I can help you find work. And it's sort of done through word of mouth. And I'm afraid that, you know, and we see this in the West where we're trying to, you know, build metaphorical walls around Europe to send people back on boats, that it is part of the human instinct and it's so fundamental to human nature to want to better oneself. That walls, a sea, people traffickers, all of the things that could get in their way are not enough to extinguish that sense and that need to want to better yourself. And whether the people are from the Philippines or from India or from South Asia or the Far East or North Africa, and some of them end up in Europe and some of them end up in the Middle East, they're there because they can pursue opportunities that they weren't able to do so where they are at home. Exactly. And that drive, you know, in the, and ironically, so many of the Westerners that think the UAE is a slave economy do not want migrants anywhere near their own homes. And these are people that bring with them a sense of optimism, right? There's a lot of declinism in the West. That declinism comes from established populations, from the indigenous people, the majority populations. And when you're a migrant or you're the grandchild of migrants or you have the migrant mentality, you're always kind of fundamentally optimistic because mm-hmm. you've done something to break your family's,
yeah.
the pattern of your family history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's not something that we should ever sniff at.
Agreed. Well, we keep trying to be light, but
I keep getting serious.
We're getting sucked
but you're in. Living proof of this, I guess. You know, I watched your video with your father, and you're telling your own story, right? And my job is to tell other people's stories. Mm-hmm. But those are stories that need to be shared and celebrated more, because often the migrant is this faceless threat, this often man who's come to change the way your country is run.
Exactly.
Rather than the person who's striving. You know, the person
just
who
hustling
has
this, on a day-to-day.
Yes, exactly. And the other, again, another one of the sort of funny things is that we claim to like elevate hustle culture and like get better and wellness and betterment and all this. And all these people are doing that.
Yeah.
But they're just doing it in a way which is almost more existential for them. And, you know, and you're one of those people. And my story is a little bit different because of my family history. You know, I was born in the UK. But again, I guess, you know, breaking into industries where there are not many people like you is a sense in which, you know, very slowly and incrementally change happens. And, you know, it's, you know, I know that the feeling of being an outsider, but if you're a journalist, honestly, I want to always feel like I'm an outsider.
Yeah.
Because once you stop having that feeling, then you're kind of like, maybe I'm doing something wrong.
You're old news then.
Well, maybe I'm getting too close to the people I write about. Maybe I'm, you know, becoming a bit biddable. Mm. Suddenly I find myself agreeing with everyone. That's just, you know, that's usually when you kind of need to check yourself.
Mm. I like that. But how does it feel for you? You've known me since I was 18.
Again, I'm the parent. Like, now you've done boarding school and
you've graduated.
Yeah. And now, you know, we're letting a thousand flowers bloom. I mean, you have changed a lot.
In what way?
So I think being in the UK is probably like you imbibed a lot of like Britishness in like sarcasm.
Are you going to say I learned how to speak English?
You learn how to speak English better. Mm. That's partly through me. We had like an Eliza Doolittle relationship where, you know, I'm helping you out.
I'm gonna tell the story, okay? I still remember I was packing to go home for Christmas. You were in my room with Halima. Do you remember?
Yep.
And then you were putting some songs on there to JLS. Laugh. What song was it?
It was JLS. Oh, I can't remember the name of the song.
And then you kept saying I speak like them. And then I said I had some leftover Orange.
No, it was the Mowgli. Wasn't it Mowgli? No, the guy from the...
Life of Pi.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was saying I had some leftover oranges, but I did. Back in the day, I had a very thick French accent. I didn't say oranges. I said...
Oranges. As in, I've arranged these flowers for you.
And they laughed for like half an hour. That's bullying.
Do you know what, though? Karma happened. Because when I moved to a French-speaking country and didn't have a clue what was going on, and you're entirely proficient in French, then, you know, then
did you think of me then?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And did I was you like think, gosh,
oh, must have been hard for her.
No, but I was in awe of you because you can speak another language like it's your mother tongue, like so naturally, and because French would seem like such a kind of barrier for me. And I was like, god, Sheen would just, you know, this is just nothing to her. Yeah, so it came back to bite.
Do you remember when we went to Paris and you tried to order in French and they kept replying in English?
They just speak back to me in English. They're like, oh, le rose beef. Like, they already knew what I was. Yeah. And in a way, it was quite nice to be considered le rose beef because it's like, oh, they just...
Did they call you the le rose beef?
Yeah, they did. Oh. One guy just muttered it under his breath. I was like, oh, si vous plaît, la la. And he was like, oh, c'est le rose beef. Yeah, that's what he said. To people who don't understand, that's a kind of ethnic slur that's used against British people.
Slur.
Yeah, it is. I kind of felt like, oh, I've arrived. Like, people actually think I'm English.
They think I'm a roast beef.
They think I'm roast beef. Like, they think I'm a gammon. So that was, in a way, it was a backhanded compliment. But yeah, I do remember being in Paris and like just watching you thrive. And I was like, god, I can't do any of this.
I was just saying hello and you were like, oh my god, you speak French.
Yeah. And you can like, you know, have pitter patter with like people on the street. And I'm like, I look like, please don't speak to me. Please don't talk to me. I know three words. Once I've exhausted them. Oh, yeah, exactly.
That was that song you kept singing that you learned in school. Like Piscine or Bibliothèque or something.
Napoleon song. There was a song about Napoleon we learned at school by him going up marching up a mountain or something.
Wow. Well, yeah. Okay, so we've also traveled a lot together. We've been to Brussels, Belgium.
You stayed with me in Belgium.
Yeah, remember we went to Bruges as well.
Yeah.
Where was the other place I went to? Ghent. No, that's Germany.
Yeah, no. Can we keep this in?
Yeah.
Your sense of geography is appalling. Did you say Ghent is in Germany?
Where is Ghent?
You've been to Germany. That didn't go that well. Ghent is also in Brussels, in Flanders, so the northern part of Brussels.
See, I was right. I said Ghent and then I looked at your face and I was like, wait, is that Germany?
We went to Ghent and we went to Bruges and you came to stay with me in Brussels. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we've been to Paris together.
Japan,
which is a great trip. Japan was lit. Yeah, brilliant.
I went for a conference. And how long were we at the conference for? Technically, the university paid for me to go present at a conference during my PhD. We went there, put my poster up, disappeared.
Yeah, it was a really fruitful conference.
Very fruitful.
I learned so much about spines.
Yeah, correct. Good topic. And then where else are we? Dubai.
Yeah, we've been to Dubai. We've traveled around a little bit in the UAE as well.
Yeah, we have been. Where next?
I think we should go to the US.
Or Mauritius.
Or Mauritius, yeah. No, I do have to come to Mauritius I feel like, yeah, no, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for your wedding to happen.
Yeah, well.
When you take some pasty face guy over to Mauritius and
why pasty face?
I think it's not to, you know, go after people's melanin content.
I have great taste in men.
Yeah. So I think that our early part of our friendship was me wanting you how to speak English to be getting you away from like very toxic boys. Because you had like really bad taste. And I think actually over time, you've developed like this sense of like being, you know, sarcastic and a bit more hard-faced.
And I'm funny now.
And like funny in like a cutting way.
Yeah.
And you don't laugh at people's jokes so much.
No, I stopped giggling.
You stopped giggling, which we had to beat that out of
we
you.
I was a big giggler.
Because it was attracting the wrong kind of people. Because men love women who laugh at their jokes. I get told I don't laugh at anyone's jokes. I mean, that's not a surprise.
That's not surprising. Yeah.
So, yeah, you have changed for the better. I think there's been a maturation process, which I'm going to take a lot of credit for.
Yeah, and a lot of people do say I've become more like you.
Yeah.
Don't know if it's a compliment.
No. I mean, I wouldn't want anyone to become like me. No, but I think you became a bit more hard-headed and
I did.
Like a little bit more cynical, I think.
Oh, 100%.
I think cynical is like the
100%.
And more, what's the word I'm looking for?
I think I speak my mind more openly now. I used to have the views, but I would always be scared of like saying it.
And you're more discerning.
Yeah.
So you have quite a acute bullshit radar.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so that's
definitely from you as well.
And you need that in Dubai, no offense, but like Dubai you need a decent sense of like where you can detect bullshit.
Oh,
because there's a lot of bullshit here.
100%.
Yeah, so discerning, cynical, a bit hard-headed.
Funny. Please say funny.
I will give you that.
When you've
earned it as a true parent, when you've earned it.
Do you remember when I made you laugh?
Yeah, but usually for the wrong reasons.
Do you remember when I said makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, because you became a meme.
I became a meme. And now every time I say it in a very like serious space, I just want to laugh when I say, yeah, that makes sense. And I'm like, oh no.
I told you that it was raining on my birthday. And you said, well, that makes sense.
I didn't even make a sentence. I just said, makes sense.
Because you were trying to palm me because...
I was trying.
Yeah, so you're like, when you're trying to be mean to people... So this is like a classic British thing is that you're, you know, the way you show affection to people is that
I roast them.
Horribly rude to them.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I did that to you, but you were always like, maybe she doesn't like me.
I'll cry to myself to
maybe
sleep.
She likes me. Yeah. So, and then I had to tell you, look, I am emotionally incapable of just showing you how I feel. So I'm just going to be rude to you and you're going to have to accept that as my love. That's my love language.
Yeah. Just like when I came back from Germany and you provided me with so much love
and
support.
So taking the piss out of people is a very sense in which if anyone's watching this and they're in the UK and they don't understand how people operate, that's like a form of very high intimacy. And I know that's difficult, but I think we should tell. I think we should do like a how to live in the UK guide for anyone who's just like rocked up.
We should.
Yeah, especially you should. Yeah, because you've done the journey. Like
I went through the trauma.
You did go through the trauma.
Because you know now when I like, especially when it comes to guys, if I like someone, I roast them, yeah. And I'm kind of like looking for tears at this point.
Yeah.
And they will never know. They'll think this girl hates me.
It's the playground thing that boys used to pinch you.
Yeah, it's like you pull their hair.
Yeah, yeah.
But
you, I think, used to do that as well. Just beat people up in the playground. You're probably quite nasty to little boys in the playground. You've told me these things.
I mean, these things were not meant to share.
Okay.
Yeah, but I was a bully in school.
Yeah. Yeah, but so you just take that into your adult life and use that kind of sentiment that if you really, really like someone,
mm-hmm.
You just rip the living daylights out of them all the time.
Okay, we have a final thought, final question.
I'm very happy that you're so settled here. 2 years have gone by very quickly. You know, I think you're still the same person. I know we talked about, you know, how sometimes navigating Dubai is quite difficult, but yeah, I mean, you're thriving and I'm so glad that we get to sit in this bougie studio and chat like this, because it wasn't self-evident that this was the path that you were going to follow
mm-hmm.
when, you know, I left you like, you know, holding your SIM cardless phone. And not having a national ID card, and you were like about to enter the corporate world.
Yeah, different world. Well, next thing we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, let's see if we can do this again in a couple of years' time, or we won't take that long, and see where we are, where we're at.
And okay, final question, which I ask all of my guests. This is very out of context because this conversation went a different way. But what does success mean to you?
It's not monetary, so I can rule some things out. I think success for me in my particular way that I've chosen to, you know, choose to like pursue a professional life is understanding and being okay with the fact that all of this could disappear very quickly. So I would describe that less as success and more as contentedness.
Mm-hmm.
But once you can reach that level, which is very, very difficult, that's when you probably know that you've done something right. Is that all of the things that I spend all my time thinking about and being preoccupied with, that a lot of it can just disappear like that. And I will be okay if that ever happens. So some, I guess, stoic degree of acceptance about the fragility of all the things that seem very important for me is success, because that probably means I've got a good head on my shoulders, and whatever the next thing might be, I'll be able to pursue it without hurting or, you know, mourning too much for what I might have lost.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here.
That was deep.
Okay. Thank you. And hopefully we'll see you soon.
Bye.